You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of August 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Emma Nelson. On today's show...
The U.S. goal right now would be to make sure that the ceasefire holds, that Gaza can begin the process of rebuilding, and that some measures are taken so that the people of Gaza feel some sense of hope.
While the truce lasts in Gaza, Israel asks Germany to step in and play a bigger role. My studio guests will examine just how much global influence one nation can wield, because we also keep Germany very much in mind as we assess what Der Spiegel has described as the wreckage of diplomacy, while Angela Merkel does her best to keep Vladimir Putin in check. And...
I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's going to give you what you want.
It's too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
We talk to the author of a weighty new book on the Godfather himself, Marlon Brando. All that, plus we check in with our correspondent in Estonia, we review the best books of the week, and we listen to one of those lovely summer songs as well. That's Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, right now. So lots coming up, but before that, let's get the latest world news now from Suzanne Chislett.
The European Commission says it regrets Russia's decision to ban all imports of agricultural produce from the US, EU, Australia, Canada and Norway. Moscow's confirmed the move in response to international sanctions imposed because of its role in the Ukrainian conflict. EU Commission spokesman Frédéric Vincent spoke to reporters in Brussels.
The European Union regrets the announcement by the Russian Federation of measures which will target imports of food and agricultural products. The announcement is clearly politically motivated. Following a full assessment by the Commission on the Russian Federation's measures, we reserve the right to take action as appropriate.
The Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, has visited Ukraine today for talks aimed about what the alliance could do to help Kiev as it continues to battle pro-Russian separatists. He's called on Russia to withdraw the 20,000 troops NATO says have been massed near the shared border and to step back from the brink. Pope Francis is urging world leaders to act to help end the insurgency in northern Iraq. Tens of thousands of Christians have fled their homes after fighters from the radical Islamist group, the Islamic State, seized control of the town where many of them live. Other minorities are also fearing persecution. The UN says many of the hundreds of members of the Yazidi community who fled to the mountains and were in desperate need of food and water have now been rescued. The United Nations has paid tribute to the 11 UN Relief and Works Agency staff who were killed in the Gaza conflict. A special ceremony has taken place in Geneva, where the names of the dead were read out and the UN flag flew at half-mast. Ian Richards is the president of the Coordinating Committee of International Staff Unions and Associations.
We don't think it can be tolerated, and we've asked for accountability on this. We've written to the Secretary General, the General Assembly and the Security Council to ask that they take active measures to ensure that those who do kill UN staff or those involved in those actions are held to account.
Talks aimed at extending the three-day ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas are continuing. The 72-hour truce is due to expire in 14 hours. Israel has said it's willing to extend it, but Hamas wants certain conditions to be met first. Sierra Leone's military is now blockading rural areas where people have become infected with the deadly Ebola virus as attempts to halt the outbreak continue. In Liberia, which has also been hard hit, a state of emergency has been declared. More than 930 people have died in West Africa since the outbreak began in February. Two US aid workers have been flown home for treatment, as has a Spanish priest who contracted the illness. In Nigeria, more people are being tested for Ebola after initial cases were confirmed there. The health commissioner in Lagos, Jide Idris, says resources are being stretched too far.
We need volunteers now to assist us in tracking the contacts and, more importantly, to manage those cases that are already in isolation. If we want to give them a chance for life, they need to be properly managed. So we need doctors. We need nurses.
The American former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who's wanted in the US for leaking secrets, has been given an extended visa to stay in Russia. Snowden's been living in Moscow since arriving there last year when he was on the run. His temporary residency permit has now been extended to 3 years, and he could apply to become a Russian citizen after 2018. The US Secretary of State John Kerry is in Afghanistan for talks with the two men who want to replace Hamid Karzai as president. On his second trip to Kabul in as many months, the US diplomat will try to push Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani to stick to a deal to share power, which was worked out when Kerry was there in July. The two men are said to be at odds over several key parts of the agreement, which followed the disputed runoff election. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. We'll be back in just a moment with a full roundup of today's news, and we'll discuss them in the studio in just a minute.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 if you're listening on a New York lunchtime. We normally at this stage, as you will know full well, have a half-hour discussion of the day's news. And we begin today with a call from Israel to Europe. Avigdor Lieberman, the Israeli foreign minister, has asked for European inspectors along the border with Gaza and for Germany to coordinate it and the organisation of a lasting peace for Gaza. Mr Lieberman said the patrols would control the movement of goods between the Palestinians and neighbouring states. It is quite a request. Joining me now with their take on this and the rest of today's news here in the studio is Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Sebastian Borger, who is the London correspondent for the Berlin-based magazine Cicero, and he also writes for Spiegel Online. Welcome both to the programme. Let me begin with you, Kathleen. When I heard this story, I didn't want to dwell too much on the past, but I suddenly found myself thinking, 2 decades on, we have completely flipped Germany and Israel's role.
Well, it's not that so much that hit me, as it were, is partly that is Israel playing on Germany's guilt, but also Israel is obviously responding to the fact that Germany is now the most powerful country, and if Germany does it, the others will follow. And it's going to be easy, and the assumption, I presume, is that Germany, if they don't do it, they're going to feel really guilty if they don't.
Sebastian, would you agree with this?
It's completely ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. Now, I've only read it on the website of Bild Zeitung, which is the biggest tabloid in Germany. As far as I understand it, it was an exclusive interview they had with Lieberman. Has he actually repeated it in any sort of official sort of way? I don't think so. I think it's part of the silly season in August.
That's quite a statement you make to say that this is part of the silly season, because this is the least silly story that you could possibly imagine. Are you trying to say that Bild is inaccurate in its reporting?
No, what I mean is Mr. Lieberman knows exactly that Germany will not do anything on their own. They are part of the European Union. They are very happy to get engaged. Israel, over the last 10, 20 years, has always told the EU to go and do whatever they like. So it's a maneuver. It's maybe playing on Germany's guilt, that's fine. It's a maneuver to deflect attention away from what's happening in Gaza.
And granted, you say that Germany acts within Europe, but Israel is really targeting very precisely the possibly the weakest link within Europe, which is actually Germany's obligations.
The weakest link in what way? I don't understand. Sorry. Mr. Lieberman is someone who lives in an illegal settlement on the West Bank. The Israeli government's policy during this whole war has been completely outrageous, as the UN Secretary General has quite rightly said. To now come along and have an interview with Bild Zeitung in Germany and say that Germany should send inspectors to do what?
Kathleen, you wanted to talk.
Well, it's just there's one other aspect one ought to consider, which is that Israel, in a sense, is thumbing their nose at the United States, which would be the country to whom they would normally appeal. They are not, which is more or less saying, you can't, you won't do anything. You're not any longer powerful, which has been said privately in Jerusalem. And Germany is powerful, and if we can lure her in, I mean, there are things they could do. There is, after the Eubom, you know, the European border assistance mechanism or whatever, which was set up in 2005 and then shut down in 2007, but actually monitored the traffic between Rafah, between Gaza and Egypt. If they can get that back, it's a way possibly of helping Gaza to open up a bit to the outside. So I don't think it's, I take Sebastian's point. It seems quite bonkers, perhaps, to the outside, but I think I can sort of see just what Lieberman is trying to do.
I mean, what struck me about the request was that it wasn't just humanitarian. This was a request for military assistance. And it was, in fact, responding to an offer that has been made about from Germany, Britain and France to actually engage in some sort of help, to offer some sort of service. So in what way do you think that you're... To what degree is the military request the surprising element of this? Or are you at all surprised by this request? Kathleen?
Whose particular request?
The request from Lieberman to Germany in particular, or is he just responding to something which was made, to an offer that was made on a more general basis from Germany, France and Britain?
I think he's trying to take what there is on the table and run with it to the extent that he can. I mean, it's going to be difficult because there was a long interview with the chap in Cairo, who is Hamas's political point man there. And he makes it quite clear that although Hamas political wing and the Fatah political wing will come together and continue to be in a unity government, that the military wing of Hamas is not going to be pulled back.
Sebastian, let me turn to you now. There's an article due to come out in Bild tomorrow, a reply from Frank-Walter Steinmeier, the German foreign minister. He says that together with our European partners, we are ready to make a contribution, for example, with an EU monitoring mission of the border crossing. To what degree do you think that this will actually be, as you say, the moment when Germany manages to use Europe as its strength? But nonetheless, domestically, it is still a problem.
No, sorry. I don't see a problem domestically at all. The problem is that the European Union has tried to engage with this conflict over the decades, and has always been accused by Israel of being too pro-Palestine, and has more than one occasion been told to go away, and we deal with our American friends now. Now suddenly, as the Americans aren't so popular anymore, they're turning to Europe. I think it's a stunt. By all means, if both sides are happy to agree that the European Union can play a useful role, obviously it should.
Okay, let's move on to our second German-themed subject of today. There was a phone call yesterday between the German Chancellor and the Russian President after several days of radio silence. Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin are thought to have discussed Russia's continued support for the Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine, and Angela Merkel is pushing hard for Mr. Putin to withdraw his support. Let me start with you, Sebastian, because there's a quote from Der Spiegel, which is who you work for. They're saying that the Russian-German relations now are the worst that they have been for, well, since the Cold War. And they're saying that the wreckage of Flight MH17, which is the Malaysia Airlines flight, which was ostensibly shot down, is the wreckage of diplomacy. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can't, I don't think you can imagine the kind of debate that's been in Germany about relations with Russia. We have a long-standing, I would almost say, friendship with Russia. We have, you know, that there's in both Western and Eastern political elites, there's a tremendous depth of, call it guilt or call it remembrance of the of the terrible suffering of the Soviet Union, the mainly Russian, but also other peoples during the Second World War, and what we did to that country. And, of course, the Ostpolitik, the relations to the Soviet Union, were used by German politicians to get some leeway within the NATO alliance during the Cold War. But the way Putin is behaving, and particularly after the shooting down of the airliner, has really, I think, shocked a lot of people.
Kathleen, the key to all this in the past few months, not least, has been the very, very communicative relationship enjoyed between Putin and Merkel. Much is made of the fact that they both speak each other's languages. Historically, they culturally know each other incredibly well. They are, by all accounts, good at correcting the interpreters who are on the line with them. This is an astonishing point where you see one woman who is now almost responsible for the channel of communication between Russia and the outside world. Would you agree with that?
I think you're quite right. I mean, Merkel comes from East Germany. Putin was the KGB leader in East Germany, both German, both Russian, as you say, and indeed a deep, in Germany, a deep pride almost amongst many in understanding Russia, being close to them, understanding in a way that the dumb Americans don't, and so forth, that somehow they knew what Russia was doing, thinking, wanted, that when and no one else did. This has been shattered. One gathers an awful lot of the interest groups in Germany are dumbfounded. They're silent. MH17 and indeed the Russian the Russians, not the Russians so much, but the rebels in the East, stealing and picking over the graves and so forth. And what that meant was that Merkel just wouldn't speak to Putin after July the 20th. It's been more than just a few days radio silence, I think. They spoke again yesterday on Wednesday. But what is she going to say? She said that it has to be political. She says that, perhaps economic. We're not going to do military. Putin, you have to care about economics to respond to economics. He doesn't care about economics, as far as one can tell. He cares about military and strategy. So they're already, when they are talking, they're talking past each other. It's interesting, as you say, that she's the conduit. And if she isn't talking to him, it's going to be difficult. But because it will be difficult, she's obviously going back to it as a matter of supreme responsibility.
Sebastian, what Kathleen has just described there is almost one of those, correct me if I'm wrong, there's an expression of Zugzwang, which is whichever move you make, you're going to fail. She is obviously going to be getting the ire or experiencing the ire of German industry and German businesses who will feel sanctions biting, and we'll come to the later sanctions in a moment. But she's also going, if she doesn't do something about keep the lines open, but she's also in dire trouble if she doesn't crack down hard on Putin with the rest of the world.
Yeah. No, and I honestly think that MH17 has changed, as Kathleen described, the way lobby groups in Germany talk about Russia. I mean, but as you point out, the German industry has lobbied vociferously against sanctions, and they're suddenly very quiet. And they realize that, in the face of this outrage, you can't argue with money anymore. In a rich country.
Could I just ask Sebastian a question there? I'm interested in what he says. What I want to know, since imports to Russia only constitute 3% of German exports to Russia. Right. Why has business been so concerned? Has this been large business? It's been lobbying.
I think, again, that's part of the history. The industry has always been very keen on this market, and they see, obviously, a very attractive market in the long run. Had Putin not run his country into the ground economically, Russia would look a lot better nowadays, and Germany is interested in exporting there.
There is also, very briefly, before we have to move on in a moment, the issue of power as well, because how dependent is Germany on power?
And absolutely.
If Russia cuts that off, then the ramifications are very wide-reaching.
Yes, but again, I mean, that's the argument that the what we call the understander, the understanding people, the Putin understanders, have brought up over the last few months. And I think quite rightly others have argued that, you know, he cuts off energy. That's too bad for us. It's very, very bad for him as well. You know, if the Russians don't export their energy anymore, what will they export? How will they run their country? They're going to go bankrupt.
They have almost no industry. It has to be commodities. It has to be raw materials.
You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll discuss two men of Europe, well, one man of the present and one man perhaps of the future, Matteo Renzi and Boris Johnson. Stay with us.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
...1921 in Rome, 1821 here in London. Still with me is Sebastian Borger and Kathleen Burke. It's generally, it's thought, a matter of time before the shine comes off any new national leadership. And it's generally around 6 months when this happens, it is said. So, is it any great surprise then that Italy's young, sharp and can-do Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has found himself dealing with a serious wave of criticism since he took office for the first time? Well, he came to power on a mandate of widespread labour reforms and tax cuts, but this week Italy slumped back into recession and GDP has shrunk. Sebastian Borger, Matteo Renzi, is he really just experiencing what every leader experiences?
And with particular stress in Italy, isn't it? I mean, when you look at Italy's post-war history, is he the 52nd, 53rd or 54th prime minister? I'm not entirely sure. The problem, of course, for him, as for his predecessor, who he so very unpleasantly decapitated, is that there are tremendous lobby groups in his own party and in the rest of the country who don't want to move. Well, then there's very little you can do as a leader apart from looking good on television.
Would you agree, Kathleen Burke?
Well, he says he went for the Senate first, which, in other words, trying to reform it, because, of course, they can stop almost anything that goes through. Now, the question, he says that's why he has to do it. Others say he evaded the really difficult problems like immovability of the labor market, for example, tax evasion, so forth and so on. The problem is beauty only takes you so far, I think, and it isn't taking him far enough in terms of negotiations with the really powerful collective barons of Italian industry and labor.
Perhaps you're hitting the nail on the head there. I mean, as professor of modern and contemporary history, you will no doubt have seen this happen before. You will certainly know about all this happening before. To what degree are these barons, whether in contemporary industry or within politics or anywhere in Italy, the big problem that Renzi has to get round?
Well, I think they are. I mean, you can't really do much of anything with labor without running into laws. That means that it's even more difficult than in France to get rid of employees who are a dead loss. In the public sector, you have people who go into the office and then, you know, are there for 15 minutes and go out and begin having their coffee outside. In other words, there's no sanctions. You can't tighten up. You can't increase efficiency. And Italy's GDP has plummeted in the past few years 7%. You know, that's an awful lot of money. And the problem is people won't take this on board. And he's decapitation, as Sebastian said, well, sounds a bit bloody, but I take his point. But Renzi's going to be in grave difficulty because he doesn't really have a party behind him. So we will possibly wait and see just how long before that lovely head goes into a basket.
Conversely, while this lovely head is threatened domestically, about a month ago, Renzi went to Europe, Sebastian, and he said he wanted Italy to be a driving force in the reform of Europe. He wanted to be, he wanted his country to no longer be basically the beggar of the continent. I mean, to what degree is he being welcomed by other member states?
Well, I think that's absolutely great. The problem always, of course, is lovely to be to have someone who is positive about Europe, but you've got to do your homework. He hasn't done his homework. You know, you can talk in beautiful, colourful language all you like about Europe, and send your very pretty foreign minister as a candidate who has been in a job for what, 3, 4, 5 months, to be a candidate, a serious candidate apparently, for the European Union Foreign High Commission, or whatever they call it. I don't know. It's not entirely serious.
Well, let's move on to one person who has not always been described as entirely serious either. He made the role of London's mayor a global force. One need only remind ourselves of him standing on top of a bus in Beijing during the closing of the Olympics a few years ago. And in the UK, it'd be hard to press to find a Londoner or indeed a British person who hasn't heard of Boris Johnson. And now, after years of speculation, Mr. Johnson has announced he's to stand for election as mayor, as a member of the UK Parliament. Now, this may not be massively important to anybody who isn't directly affected about it, but it is being interpreted as his first step on the march to Downing Street. Well, still with me is Kathleen Burke and Sebastian Borger. Kathleen, again, the historical perspective of this, Boris Johnson sort of loves to live in history. He likes to quote, he is a direct descendant of Ataturk, no less. But yeah, and you may be surprised to hear that. But he is a driving force who may be able to bring Britain hard and fast onto the global stage again.
Well, two things. First of all, you can't help but like someone who can speak, quote, Latin without having to look at a crib sheet. Secondly, he can't be a driving force unless he gets elected. Now, he is very boisterous. He is very charismatic. He flays himself all the way around. People do find him very enjoyable to listen to. My daughter loved hearing him coming to her school and talking. She can't vote, of course, so that there's a problem there. The thing is, he has got a backstory that is going to make the newspapers burble. I shouldn't start detailing it over international radio.
Please do.
Here.
Please do.
You can pay for the legal fees, Sebastian, if she does.
But the problem is, he's not very organized. He doesn't do his homework. There's even stories of him when he was an MP not noticing he was going into the wrong side of the lobby and voting with the opposition and not quite realizing it. The idea that this man is going to lead a major country would be laughable if it weren't so ridiculous.
You say that, but he has done things, Sebastian, hasn't he, for London, which may not have been terribly popular with Londoners. He's this funny, strange character. I've interviewed him a few times, and he's terribly charming, but he lacks detail when you ask him. You can pick him up very easily on things that I am no expert on, but he seems to bumble and fluster. But what he's managed to do for London is astonishing insofar as he has brought tremendous amounts of internal investment. We have Malaysia buying...
I disagree. Sorry.
But
I totally
perhaps
disagree.
At the expense of the Londoners.
No. London is a global city. Whoever is in charge, it doesn't matter. There are all these oligarchs from all over the world, as well as reasonable businessmen interested in investing in London. Ken Livingstone did exactly the same. His predecessor as mayor, the Labour candidate, did exactly the same. Boris Johnson is a great figurehead, is great fun, is very charismatic, and in that way a good mayor for London. But come on, imagine him in a serious discussion around the table at the EU. Boris Johnson. I mean, Britain is in all sorts of ways going slightly bonky, but slightly...
I quite like bonky. Continue.
I beg your pardon. Going slightly mad at the moment, I feel. But that would really be the icing on the cake.
The people who would really like it, of course, are political cartoonists. Can you just imagine the cartoons in the newspapers if he actually had a serious chance of coming to power?
We would have, admittedly, a real return to character politics, which in many ways is a welcome thing. But Sebastian, you say that, you know, he's not that serious, but he is a deeply serious person when it comes to actually Boris Johnson. I mean,
very ambitious.
To the stage where, you know, three people here talking about him and he hasn't even been elected as a member of parliament.
Well, we all know that he will find a very safe conservative seat. He will get elected. Then, of course, it depends. If Cameron, which seems unlikely, admittedly, but if he wins an outright majority, is Boris then going to serve as the trade and industry minister in the government? I doubt it very much.
We'll see. Kathleen Burke and Sebastian Vaughan, my thanks to you both very much for joining me here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our correspondent in Estonia and we'll meet the author of a new book on Marlon Brando. But before we get started on all that, here's Suzanne with the latest news.
Thank you, Emma. The European Commission says it regrets Russia's decision to ban all imports of agricultural products from the EU, US, Australia, Canada and Norway. Moscow has confirmed the move because of international sanctions imposed in response to its role in the Ukraine conflict. The Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, has been in Ukraine today for talks about what the alliance could do to help Kiev as it continues to battle the pro-Russian rebels. He's called on Russia to withdraw the 20,000 troops NATO says have been massed near the shared border and to step back from the brink. The Pope has urged world leaders to act to help end the insurgency in northern Iraq. Tens of thousands of Christians have fled their homes after fighters from the radical Islamist group, the Islamic State, seized control of the town where many of them live. And the UN has paid tribute to the 11 UN relief works and agency staff who were killed in the Gaza conflict. A special ceremony has taken place in Geneva where the names of the dead were read out and the UN flag flew at half-mast. Talks aimed at extending the three-day ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas are continuing in Egypt. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Suzanne. Suzanne will be back at the top of the hour to bring us a full roundup of today's news. And then after that, Andrew Tuck will be here to bring you this week's episode of The Urbanist. But in the meantime, you're listening to Midori House. This is Emma Nelson and the time here in London is 18:32. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we head to Estonia. Joining us on the line is Liis Kangsepp. Liis, a very warm welcome to the programme. We've just spent the last few moments talking about Russia and its increasingly troubled position on the world stage. It has dealt a blow to Europe today, hasn't it, with its agricultural embargo?
Yes, indeed. And the problem here is here in Estonia, it's quite big as well. The papers have been talking about it the whole day and people are getting a little bit worried.
What are the concerns there?
Well, the concerns are that about 10% of our export goes to Russia, and from that 10%, about 20% of our export that goes to Russia is agriculture and food. So we send quite a lot of food and agricultural products to Russia, and this ban affects quite a few companies here in Estonia.
The Prime Minister has said it's too early to speak about the effect the Russian ban could have, but obviously the scale and the breadth of the items that are going to be banned, which is dairy, meat, vegetables, the lot, it will mean that Estonia will have to look elsewhere. Where can Estonia sell its goods to, if not Russia?
Well, it's a very difficult and tricky question because most of our export goes to our neighbouring countries like Finland, Latvia and Sweden and Russia. And Finland and Latvia, their export markets are also very connected to Russia, which means that Estonian companies really have to go through and find new markets for their products, which is going to be tricky because, you know, the ban does not affect only Estonia, but other countries who are not able to sell their products to Russia, which means that they're going to be stuck with their products, trying to sell them somewhere. which makes it very difficult for Estonian companies to find a new market, I think.
To what degree can they rely on the European Union, which has obviously received this embargo, to help perhaps in whatever way?
Nothing very concrete has been said yet, but as far as I understand, the Estonian government is looking into ways of finding a solution and finding support from both from inside Estonia and from the European Union.
Let's move on, Lise, to another story that's been making the headlines, which is the ownership of Estonian forests. Why has that become such a controversial issue?
It's a little bit complicated for me to say because I just read the story this morning and it turns out that about 5% of the forest we have belongs to foreign companies, quite big foreign companies. And the issue in the newspaper seemed to be that these companies are not willing to sell the land to people who are interested in buying it but want to pay market value for it. Which, in a way, is a little bit funny because I believe that when you own something, you have the right to ask for a price for it as well.
So, what is the controversy there? Is this as you say, who is the loudest voice complaining about this?
People who have been trying to buy land and have been met with a concrete wall, saying by this big company, saying that they are not able to buy this piece of land they want to have, where they want to build their houses and want to live. But from the story, I understand there are not so many people who have tried to do it, and I think people are just a little bit afraid that foreigners will come to Estonia and just keep on buying our land, and then in the end we will end up with nothing, and also. When we don't have enough land anymore, these big companies who just use this forest for their own purposes, they will not care about the people who actually live in Estonia and are, you know, using the land for something, or would like to use the land for something completely different.
Indeed, how is this now an argument about land use? Because what are these international companies doing buying up swathes of Estonian forest, if only to sit on them and make money? And what is the need that's being expressed by people in Estonia for more land?
This is really an issue in the story I don't really understand either, because I picked this story because it's summer and this is one of the stories that goes a little bit around circling. So I think people are just maybe a little bit upset that they are not able to buy a forest with a price they would like to pay for it, and they are afraid that these international corporations don't really care about our forests, which might not necessarily be true because they still have to take care of it, and they can't just let it stand there and rot, so to speak.
Absolutely. Lise, let's move on to a festival of opinion that's being organised in Estonia. That sounds brilliant fun.
Yes, it's going to be great fun. It's a festival that's been organised for the second time this year, and I'm also part of the volunteers who is helping to organise it, because it's an incredible festival that's organised only by volunteers. There is nobody gets paid for doing this festival, and the leader Kristi Liva, she got inspiration in Sweden, where they have where every summer people gather in an island for an event they call Almedalen Week, where they discuss important issues for Sweden and try to find new ideas how to make Sweden a better place for everybody. So we are kind of doing the same thing. So we are trying to bring people together so that they would debate and discuss different issues about Estonia, about the present day of Estonia and about the future, and also what kind of future they would like to see for Estonia.
And when you're breaking those big issues down, what are the key topics that seem to be coming back and you're saying, OK, we must talk about this?
I think this year a lot of the topics are related to education, because we are going through a sort of education reform, so people are really curious about education. Of course, another big topic that has been surfacing everywhere is security. So we have quite a few discussions and debates about security and how to increase Estonian security in a situation where Russia is acting very unpredictably and with everything that's going on in Ukraine. So I think a lot of Estonians are very nervous about the situation in Ukraine and the situation in Russia.
And who are you bringing in to talk about this? Who are the key speakers?
Oh, all sorts of different people. We have about 500 different people who are going to be participating in the debate. We have 160 events scheduled for 2 days. I think for international audiences, who might be somebody who is a little bit more known is the Transport Commissioner of the European Commission and the Vice President of the European Commission, Siim Kallas. But also the Prime Minister, Taavi Rõivas, is coming, all sorts of different former Prime Ministers, entrepreneurs, a lot of NGOs. Because we are organizing this event together with a lot of different organizations and NGOs. We have about 80 organizations that help us put together the program and all the events.
Lise Kangsepp, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line from Estonia. Up next, we'll join by the author of a new book on Marlon Brando. Stay tuned.
Spirit, love, energy, and culture. To be quickly accessible, unreroute the river, let the damned water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
It has just gone 1841 if you're listening in Algiers, and in London too you're listening to Midori House. Now, he was a man who treated his celebrity as a means to an end. One need only remember his Oscar acceptance speech, or rather his refusal, in 1973 when he sent an American Indian in his place. But he was also a man who liked to stamp his mark on every film he starred in, and as a result he graced the posters of millions of students' walls. Now, a new book closely examines Marlon Brando's life. It's called Brando's Smile. And its author is Susan L. Mizrahi. She joins me on the line now from New York. A very warm welcome to the studio, Susan. Tell me a little bit about what made you, what drew you to writing another biography on Brando. What was the gap that you felt needed to be filled?
Well, I grew up on Brando films, and I was always fascinated by him. And I always wanted to know more about the person behind the acting. And what happened is when Brando died in 2004, all of these new materials became available, and I started looking into them. And what I found is that there had been a gaping hole in our understanding of this person who is widely considered to be the greatest American actor of the 20th century. And so my central discovery here is that Brando had a mind. And the argument is that we've been so preoccupied with the body, whether the young and beautiful Brando of Streetcar or The Wild One, or the Brando who got old and fat in The Score, that we've overlooked that his curiosity about the world, his craving for knowledge, was really as great as his more legendary appetites for women and food. And what made this new side of him available was his 4,000 book library and my access to his personal scripts, which were all heavily annotated. Many of them, I discovered that Brando wrote many of his best lines in his films.
I mean, just building on that idea of everybody saw him as a body, either beautiful or less so as he grew older. It's funny because I've always thought of Marlon Brando in exactly the opposite. I've thought less about his films and more perhaps about his campaigning and the fact that he wanted to start up a sort of a teaching school called Lying for a Living. And then, you know, we need only think of that the Oscar refusal speech. That do you sometimes feel, though, that as a result, or I sometimes feel that Marlon Brando's films are overlooked and Marlon Brando, the personality, always took over too much?
Well, it's interesting what you're saying about the prominence for you of his social activism. And it certainly, you know, just a major part of his life, his work on behalf of the American Indians, his turning down the Oscar, as you mentioned in your introduction, and the and then his work for civil rights. And it is, he was certainly someone who achieved a kind of fame, which I think in some ways is just, you know, incomparable to anything we have today. He was such a, he was one of the, you know, Time Magazine's 100 most important people, one of two actors to, you know, of the 20th century to achieve that. And so it is true that he was a public figure as much as anything. If you think of his legacy, I think the impact he had on other actors who became social activists, people like Jane Fonda or Sean Penn or Angelina Jolie, was great. But he and there's no question about it. It's interesting to me, again, that as a British film viewer, that's what you recall. But, you know, in America, he was known for his major film roles. And again, it was the early ones. It was The Wild One, the biker in that film, or Stanley Kowalski in A Streetcar Named Desire. And one of the things that is so crucial in his papers and in what was revealed by the scripts and also the books is how seriously he took acting. His whole career, he could easily have been, you know, a kind of stable, unchanged, immutable icon. He could have just stuck with the roles of the thug or the hunk, which is the way I think many American audiences see him, the inarticulate, macho man. And, you know, Brando is understood as defining a certain kind of masculinity in the 1950s that extended, you know, through to our own time, really. And I think that these materials reveal him to have been absolutely deliberate and thoughtful about all of his roles, and also someone who wanted to challenge himself continuously as an actor.
To interrupt, Susan, you mentioned a moment ago that Marlon Brando changed many of the lines in his scripts. Which lines that made Marlon Brando so famous are him and not what was on the script?
Well, one of the most famous is that fabulous moment in The Godfather where Bonacera, the undertaker, has just left, and Brando says to Robert Duvall's, you know, consigliere Tom Hagen character, "We're not murderers, despite what this undertaker says." And then he drops his chin, and he inhales the rose. That line, that gesture, that inhaling of the scent of the rose, that's all Brando. That's all improvisation. And he did things like that in all of his films. I mean, I have, far too many examples to mention, but, you know, an example from the I Could Have Been a Contender speech and On the Waterfront is the way Brando changed the order of the words and also pared down the language in that scene. And, you know, I set side by side the original script to Brando's revisions, and it's a completely different feeling in that scene. And, you know, in that case, Bud Schulberg, who was a screenwriter for On the Waterfront, credited Brando directly with it. You know, highlighted, you know, the things that Brando changed, and, you know, credited him with having transformed that scene in the taxi cab in particular. A lot of what Brando does in films as well is to eliminate language. You know, he understood one of the reasons the book is called Brando's Smile is, you know, to emphasize how seriously Brando understood the face, the human face. He talked about the film actor's face as his stage.
Suzanne Mizraki, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. And Susan's book, Brando Smile, is out now. You're listening to Midori House. And in a few moments' time, we will be continuing a literary theme where we have a look at this week's best books. But taking us there, and because it's summer, let's have a bit of Milky Chance. That was The Boy from Kassel. That was Milky Chance with Stolen Chance that made huge, huge impacts on the charts all over in the kind of likes of Austria and Belgium last year. Wonder why. It's 1852 here in London. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is time to review the best and sometimes the worst in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books and more. Today, we turn to books and we're joined by Alexander Starrett. He's the literary critic for the Times Literary Supplement, among other publications. Welcome to the studio, Alex. Alexander, let's talk generally about the health of books at the moment. Are the books that you've brought in for us today, Andras Neumann, Helen MacDonald and Niall Williams, symptomatic of good stuff that's on the market at the minute?
Well, they're all very different, and I would say they're each symptomatic of their genre, as it were. I mean, the Helen MacDonald book is about a hawk, and there are a lot of good books out at the moment about man's relationship with nature. Which sounds really boring and quite pompous, but there are lots of good things in that field at the moment. The Niall Williams is from the Booker long list and is the kind of thing that everyone has seen 100 times before. It's a sort of family, three generations in this Anglo-Irish family, and the way that family traits are passed on through them, and the life of the village, which of course is not new at all, but can be still well done.
Well, let's start then with Helen MacDonald, H is for Hawk, published by Jonathan Cape. Factual, autobiographical. This woman is a falconer, and this book is all about this, we assume.
Yes, well, she's an amateur falconer. She's really an academic in Cambridge, but when she was a child, she was completely obsessed with hawks, and not just obsessed in that kind of geek culture way of saying, oh, I just happen to be quite interested in something. She even would, when she was going to sleep, would try to fold her arms behind her back the way hawks do when they're asleep. I mean, she's completely obsessed by them. And when her father dies, she decides to buy a hawk and try to tame it as a way of coping with his death. It sounds like a sort of, oh, I talk to my pet bird when I'm sad about my dad kind of thing.
It sounds a little bit more dangerous than that.
Exactly. I mean, because this animal is incredibly wild. She describes it as a spooky, pale-eyed psychopath. Whenever it hears a baby crying, it starts to get this kind of killing lust and start, you know, its pupils dilate, its talons clench on her fist. It's very much a crazy, murderous wild animal, at least to begin with.
And this is a book that the beast that is described as a bad boy of the sky. I mean, you say this is the purchase of a hawk, which follows the death of her father. Is this a book about mourning loss, or is this a book about going into falconry in a big way?
Well,
in your kitchen.
Well, I mean, it's both of those things. The grief that we see is astonishingly well presented in that. She really is cracking up. The contract at Cambridge is coming to an end. She completely fails to do anything about it. She's offered another job, turns it down because she wants to focus on the hawk. She has to move out of her house because she has no money anymore and can't even do the packing because she's so bereaved. All she can do is sit in a cardboard box and go out hawking again.
And does this resolve itself beautifully at the end? Without giving up too much away. Because when you have an autobiographical tale, you sometimes wonder where this is at, whereabouts that particular chapter will have to naturally be rounded off.
Well, unfortunately, the book sort of ends 100 pages after the story does. So, because the whole story is of her trying to tame this hawk and trying to come to terms with the death of her father. And I don't think it's giving too much away to say that she succeeds in building up some kind of mutually beneficial relationship with the hawk. But then we have another 100 pages of her just being quite happy to own this wonderful object.
Wonderful. That was Helen MacDonald, H is for Hawk, published by Jonathan Cape. Let's move on to a book of short stories. I'm a big fan. Andras Neumann, Things We Don't Do, published by Pushkin.
Yes. Andras Neumann is super hyped and small worlds like the TLS. Roberto Bolaño, who wrote The Savage Detective, said the 21st century will belong to Andreas Neumann.
Really?
For real.
Okay.
Yeah. And he...
Well, we have 2 minutes in which to explain okay. why. Go.
Okay. Well, he's written these extremely clever, intricate short stories. And for example, they're all very high concept. For example, one of them is about two psychiatrists, each of whom believes he's in fact treating the other. One of them is about two, a couple who are so similar that when they break up, each time they try to call the other, they can't get through because the other one is calling them. So, I mean, the kind of publisher's bump says that he's playing with ideas of identity, and that's true, and it's very clever. And it's like an extremely intricate toy. The problem with it is, at least on this evidence, it kind of doesn't quite live up to the hype, because it doesn't quite come alive. The hedge doesn't overgrow the frame, to borrow a metaphor from the world of topiary. It's a kind of...
An excellent one too.
Yeah, it's a sort of the naked concept.
What a shame. I got terribly excited about that. Finally, and incredibly briefly, Niall Williams' book, History of the Rain.
It's just very surprising that it's really written by an Irish person, because it's very twee Irish. It's like every single character is an eccentric. It's all, oh, Bagara, she thought her husband was a potato. You know, I'm astonished that it's on the booker long list.
That bad?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Goodness me. I must go and read it immediately. Out of the three, Bigorra, the slightly funny short story book, or The Hawking, or the Falconry book?
The Hawk. It's wonderful. It's all written at this pitch of just below screaming. So she also is talking a lot about this other man who wrote a book about a hawk and enacted all of his sadism and repressed homosexuality on it. It's absolutely astonishing.
Alexander Starrett, you brought us a giggle a minute there. Thank you very much for your amazing choices. That was Alexander Starrett, the Times Literary Supplement critic. Thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for today's episode of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Kathleen Burke and Sebastian Borger for picking apart the day's news. My thanks also to our producer Isabel Keyser, our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chiara Rimella, and our studio manager Joel Church. Next up, after the headlines with Suzanne, is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and at 2200 hours, tune in for the Monocle Daily. Andrew Muller and myself will be behind the microphone. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time, but for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
London. Tell Beijing.
This is Monaco 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monaco 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.